as an introduction, while Martin is setting up, Martin has degrees in philosophy, psychology, and software engineering, an interesting combination, and is currently working on his PhD at University of Cambridge. Martin is an authority on Debian and is performing research focusing on quality management in free software projects. The floor is yours.
Thank you. I'll briefly talk about quality improvement in open source projects, and even though I'm an open source developer myself and I believe in open source, I'm not one of those people who tell everyone that everything has to be open source, and I'm not blind to the problems. In fact, I'm a very pessimistic person, so while other people say, oh, we've been so successful, I say, yeah, we have been, but there are those problems. And there are always problems, there are always things you can improve. And so I'm looking at that side to see what kind of issues we are facing. I think during the whole day, one word came up like all the time, which is community. And I think it's very important to think about that some more. So I will talk about that and then maybe leave out a few other slides which are of less interest. But so I'll briefly talk about quality, what does it actually mean, and then what quality assurance is about, and then I will try to combine quality assurance with open source. And then the original idea was to talk about one particular problem which I'm interested in, which is release management, the process of making new versions available, which I've identified as being one problematic area. But I think that's probably less of interest, so I might go over that more quickly. So quality is something which is really interesting to study, or actually really hard, because everyone knows what it is. So if I give two people the same product and I ask people, is it of high quality, then they will immediately be able to make a judgment. The problem is that the judgment might not be the same. One person might say, yes, it's high quality, but the other one might say, well, no, it's not. And when you ask people how to make that judgment, then they realize they actually don't know. There is a decision-making process which everyone uses, but no one is actually aware of what kind of factors are involved. It's kind of like most people know how to ride a bike, but when I ask you, can you explain to me in detail every step what you do when you ride a bike? Then you say, oh gosh, there are so many things I have to consider, I'm not actually aware of that. So when we talk about quality in an academic way, we assume, first of all, that everyone knows what quality means, but then when we come to measure it, to define it and measure it, then we realize it's actually very hard. It's very hard to come up with a measure and then say, well, this product has a quality of 9 out of 10. That simply doesn't work. So when I started my research, I looked at definitions of quality, and there are many. There are more definitions of quality than researchers looking at quality. But I've listed two of them here, which I think are quite important. So one of them is fitness for purpose, which just really makes sense, where you basically just say that everything you design, every product has some kind of purpose, and if it fulfills that purpose, then it's of high quality. So the table has some requirements. If you put something on it, it shouldn't fall down, things like that. And it's the same with software. An email application has some requirements. And the way this is usually tested is done in a really bad way, where you basically take the specification on one hand, and then you take the software, and then you simply compare the two. And then you say, well, if the software matches the specification, so conformance to specification, then it's high quality. That's how it's often done in practice. Unfortunately, it's a very bad approach, because you're assuming that the specification itself is of high quality and that it's complete. So you often get software which conforms to the specification, but the user says, well, it just doesn't do what I need to do. So even though the concept of fitness for purpose is a good one, and one which applies to open source and to any product, the way it's measured in reality is often not ideal. And in a specific case of open source, most open source projects don't actually have a written specification, so comparing them doesn't actually work. Another approach which I very much like is where you realize that quality isn't actually one thing. So you can't say 9 out of 10 quality, because what is quality? It has different meanings for different people. And why? That's because quality has different attributes. It's made up of different things. So I've listed some of them here. Efficiency, reliability, usability, all of those factors contribute to the overall quality. And what we see here is that there are different aspects, different perspectives of quality. Users, they care about different things than developers. For example, maintainability, that's something users don't care about. They want the software to work, to be efficient, not to crash. But whether the source code can be maintained, whether it's beautiful, they don't care. On the other hand, developers, they want source code to be beautiful, to be well understood, but they might care less about things like usability. And that is something we have seen, especially in the past, where those different requirements are just different and where open source doesn't meet user requirements because it's written by and usually for developers. So in the past, we had much open source software which was very efficient and beautiful, like written the source code, but which was very, very hard to use. And nowadays, it's getting much better because open source developers are recognizing that there are different needs and are interested in fulfilling them. But there is still the fundamental problem that that perception is different. So when you talk about quality assurance, then obviously like a very basic definition would be that the software does what it's supposed to do. So again, with that conformance specification, you can say that the software should meet the specification. Another way to approach it is to compare yourself to other people, to other companies, and say, our software has to do whatever it does as good or better than the competition. And people are talking about the industrial standard. So we have to implement the industrial standard or even exceed it. And Linux and open source, in many cases, meets the industrial standard. In some cases, it has definitely exceeded and redefined the industrial standard. So there are people saying that Windows has become more stable because of Linux, which was so stable. But then there are some areas where Linux doesn't meet those standards yet. Something which is very important is that quality assurance has to begin before the implementation. So in the past, there was always that view that let's write software, let's just get it done, and in the end, if we still have some time or some money left, we can always make it better. We can always debug it, test it, and then remove some code and increase the quality. But what you then realize is, first of all, there is never any time or money left. And secondly, even if there was, you would realize at the end, the source code, like the whole design, is so broken, in order to get it done right, you would have to rewrite it. And of course, there is no time for that. I think this question is particularly interesting here, because the question is, where does the source code, that open source software, come from, which you want to use? So you have been talking about community and making use of open source, but that effectively means that you're taking third-party applications and using them. And because you have safety concerns and security concerns, which other people don't have as much, the question is that third-party software appropriate to your needs? And just taking that and then adding those safety features might not be possible. So you might have to be involved from the start on.
The interesting thing here is quality cannot be added later.
Yeah.
It can be reverse engineered if it exists.
It can be
reverse engineered if it exists. I.e., if you're given something with sources which is of sufficient quality,
yeah,
you can demonstrate that it has.
Right.
A posteriori.
Right.
I'm thinking about certification
right.
material.
That's certainly a big issue as well. I think we'll come to that later, because again, the question before was, if someone contributes something, how do we know we can trust them? But I think I will come to that. And then I think a very important definition of quality assurance given by ISO is as all planned and systematic activities to ensure quality. What you usually have in mind when you talk about open source, and I think what we also had in mind, even though I'm not sure if that's the appropriate definition, but usually open source is seen as something which is done by volunteers and done by people all around the world. And that's usually people doing it for fun, people doing it in their spare time. And that's very different to that definition which is planned and systematic. Because if someone is a volunteer, then they usually just do it whenever they want to. It's not planned, it's not systematic at all. And so the question, which is really the basic question of my research, is, can you actually have assured high levels of quality when your people are volunteers? But the question I'm raising now is, we've often talked about the community today, but I think that what we haven't asked is, who is that community? Because open source is quite popular at the moment, and there are many companies or universities. There's a university project, someone works on something for a year, and then they graduate and go away. And then the university says, well, we have that source code, but the people aren't there anymore. But we can make it an open source project. We will put it on the web, put it on SourceForge, and then the community can maintain it. And it's the same with companies who are not interested in some software anymore. They say, well, let's put it out, let's make it open source, and then the community will maintain it. And I think it's the same in many cases today, where we were talking about all those people out there, and if ATM moves to open source, then they immediately are going to come and are going to help us. My question is that really going to happen? And what kind of community are you looking for? Because traditionally, open source has been volunteer and distributed, but nowadays, that's not the case anymore. James Harrison, who's doing similar research, has made a really good table. So you can be distributed, or you can be co-located, and then you can be volunteers, but you can also be paid people. And in the past, open source really was here. When I think of ATM, I'm not sure whether we're actually here. We're more here. It's more paid people. It's things like Eurocontrol, but working together with other agencies. But then again, there are many volunteers, and the question is, can you attract them? And there you have to be really creative. And I think Garfield before hit the jackpot. So when I think about it, why should I, as an open source developer, get involved? Okay, I fly a lot, but that doesn't justify me spending time on writing some software, because after all, I do pay for my flights. But then I know people, and that might sound a little bit strange, but just hold on and just be creative. I know people who like to play with trains, so they have model trains at home, and those people are also computer people. So not only have they trains, but those trains are controlled by a computer, by a Linux system. And okay, a train and a plane is different, but still, a train does have need some kind of flow control, right? And then there are people who have model planes, and I'm sure they don't want to crash into another model plane. And then I don't play games, but I know the games are really popular. There are people who are doing like flight simulation. I'm sure they need something. There are other planes. There isn't just one plane. There are many planes.
So suddenly, virtual airlines.
Yeah, Garfield before mentioned that apparently there are amateurs who have written some software. So obviously there are people outside. The question is now, how can you get them involved? You have to find some kind of incentive. So it might be that they will be able to have some good simulator, or you might be able to, if there is another crash, you could make a challenge. You could say, here's all the data we have. Would you have been able to change the software? Like, if you could write the software, if you could change it, would you have been able to avoid that collision? Things like that. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that the community, which we have been talking about, won't come automatically. Even if you make your software open source, there won't be a community which will maintain it for you. You have to attract the community. And so I think that you have to do much more thinking where that community comes from. And I think largely it's going to be distributed paid people, like Eurocontrol. We have heard that the US system is very different, but maybe there are some things where you could work together. And then I think volunteers, it might be possible to encourage them, but not by saying, well, you do use a plane, so you have to, you know, write the software. You have to find some challenge, but you have to be creative about it. Anyway, so back to the quality aspect. What we do see, and here I'm mostly talking about volunteer projects, but again, and that's something very important, is when people talk about open source, they sort of assume that there is one open source model, there is the open source model, but that's not the case. And so if you ask, is open source appropriate, can you have safety and security and quality with open source, then my question is, well, open source, that doesn't mean anything. The question is, what is your development cycle? What is your development model? And there are some projects which say like everyone is able to make changes. You don't have to test it, just make the change. If it breaks, we can always fix it later on. There are other projects, and they are all open source as well, where you have to get permission from other people who have to review your changes, and only if someone else signs off, then you can actually apply those changes. I think, well, that might be something which is indeed appropriate. Another thing we've heard are test suite entries, test suites, which obviously you need for something like flight control. But with most open source applications today, there is no test suite. The users are the test suite. But there are an increasing number of open source projects which really believe in test suites. And so it really depends on what kind of open source project do you have. And it's important to define your processes. You just have to make it clear how your community works. But it's perfectly acceptable that your community works in a different way to something where a project which doesn't have those safety concerns. So we see, or we have that assumption, that quality is often high, and there are different explanations. One of them is peer review, that because so many people look at the code, someone might be able to find it. But again, there are so many projects which assume that there are thousands of people looking at the code. You know, all those thousands of people, whereas in reality, no one looks at the code. That's just the case. So we see the quality can be high, and often is high. Cases like Linux, Apache, they wouldn't be used as much if the quality would really be not sufficient. But then we have many projects which have really bad quality, or which are unsuccessful. My favorite example is SourceForge. So SourceForge is the biggest hosting site for open source projects. And they claim to have over 100,000 projects and over 1 million developers. You see those numbers and you say, oh gosh, I mean, with so many people, you must be able to do everything. And then you start looking at the projects, and then you see, oh, this one has been in stage planning for the last 3 years, and there's no source code. And this one, there's no activity. And you actually realize that few projects are successful. And partly this is because it's so simple to create an open source project. If I have some good idea, or if I'm really bored on the weekend, I can sign up on SourceForge and I have my project. But that doesn't mean that I'm actually gonna do anything with it. So to some degree, it's justified that there are so many unsuccessful projects. But there are other reasons as well, and some reasons can be found in bad management. And then there are big projects which have problems. So I'm involved in the Debian project, which is very large. We have over 1,000 people, and we are very well known for being late with our releases. So the last release we said about 2 years ago that we were just about to make it, and then it took another 1.5 years. So there are definitely problems. So what I did was I performed some interviews, because most academic research looks at successful projects. Linux kernel, Apache, all of those great projects, and very little attention has been given to the failures or the problems. I interviewed some people and asked them, so what kind of problems do you have in your project? And I came up with three areas of interest. One of them is leadership. As I mentioned before, there isn't one open source model. There are many different models. So there are some projects where you have one person at the top who makes all major decisions. Then you have other projects where you have a team. You have some projects where you vote. For example, if you would come to Debian and you would start voting, people would just look at you and say, like, what are you doing? You're crazy. But in Apache, that's how things are being done. It's just different communities, different procedures, and unfortunately, most of them aren't written down. And so my question here is, how does the leadership style relate to quality? Is there one style which is better or more appropriate? I think in ATM, it needs to be a project which is highly controlled. You can't just let everyone in and let everyone do whatever they want to. There need to be very good procedures in place. And there need to be people who make sure that other people follow those procedures. Then the release cycle. So we have heard that release early, release often is good. Then there are some projects which release when it's ready, which in many cases means never. So in the case of Debian, there is always something you can improve, especially in a project that size with 1,000 people, 10,000 software packages. Well, when is that going to be perfect? Well, never. And that means that you say, let's release today, and then someone says, well, but I need to improve that. And then people say, well, but if you have another week, then I can tweak that bit. And then there's another delay, and it goes on and on. But then there are all kinds of different release processes. The important thing is just to think about the process which is ideal for your environment. And I think here, you can have a very fast development cycle, but the stable for end users, like the one for production, that has to be really, really, really well tested. So that will be much, much slower than many open source projects. And then there is the question increasingly with open source projects about company involvement, where companies are getting involved, like IBM. And the question is, how can you work together in a way that both the community and the company benefits? And there are some things which companies can contribute to projects which volunteers can't. So for example, many volunteer projects are really bad at writing documentation because there simply are few people who like to do that kind of work. But a company can't ship open source software and say, like the volunteers say, if you have any questions, just look at the source code. They actually need to ship some documentation. So a company could write the documentation and give it to the project. And similarly with test suites, companies are much more rigorous. They can't just make changes, they need to test it. So they could contribute that to the project. I think I'm running out of time, so I'm just jumping to the conclusions. The fundamental problem which I'm studying, how do you coordinate a project which consists mainly of volunteers, and how do you meet deadlines? You can't rely on volunteers. But I think you have to ask yourself, who is your community? Is your community actually volunteers? I doubted that the main part of your community will be based on volunteers. So that's actually might be an issue which doesn't actually come up. But so I think the main lessons here is when you talk about community, first of all, you have to identify where it comes from. If it's about volunteers, well, maybe there are some, but then you have to think, how do you get them involved? What's the incentive for them to work on something like air traffic management? Maybe there is, like video games, toy trains and things like that. But maybe there isn't. And then you have to see, well, there's Eurocontrol, maybe there are similar organizations in different states. And then you can make use by working together, pooling your efforts. And then, obviously, if you want to use other people's open source software, then how do you assure the quality of that software? Which is really a similar question you have to ask for proprietary software anyway. But for open source, it's getting even more important. One last assurance is that there is some academic research on open source quality and development. And so if you do choose to follow that route, there is some evidence and some guidelines available that open source can be viable and of high quality.
Thank you, Martin. The floor is open for questions, remarks, observations.
I don't have a remark, but I want to solicit a remark because I'm very keen to hear the BSD perspective.
In which way?
The BSD approach, too, because we have got insights from Debian. And,
well, it's a bit different. Speaking about FreeBSD, which is the one I'm working with, we try to be less political oriented than Debian. I won't get into arguments about which way is better or not. But we do try to have some quality assurance, but it's something that open source has lacked for many years. And we're always trying to improve that. I could speak for release management, which is something very interesting, and that we're trying to improve. And I think we're getting better at that. But it would take a long time to explain.
Yeah. I think the first sentence you said is the fundamental one, is that there are different communities and they just work in a different way. I'm not saying that BSD or Debian is better or worse. They're just different. We have different beliefs. And that's very important when you're establishing a new community, which you are really trying to do, is to make very clear what your community is about. And you also have to think about growth of the community, because we always say we need more volunteers, we have to be open. But then openness isn't always good, because when you're open, then you also get people who just waste your time, who always come with their great ideas and they want to talk about it, but they're not actually interested in doing any real work. And the question is, how do you get rid of those people? And that's actually something which is very hard, and which is something many projects are facing as they get bigger. Because those people who are annoying, they don't get away. But suddenly your best developers, who are in it for the fun, they will suddenly be gone. They will find a new project. So there are many issues of having and growing a community and controlling it. And I think especially in this area where you need safety, it has to be very tightly controlled, but at the same time open enough to allow for the people to get involved.
But Gary Linux and the BSD Unix is a very interesting case because the objectives are a little bit different. For example, in Linux it's always very important to write drivers for the latest hardware, which might introduce some instability in some cases. While on the other side, the BSD folks are much more controlled. And they say, no, we don't want to support all this new stuff. What we need is a very stable kernel. And most of the BSD users, they check what we support and then they buy the hardware accordingly. Hmm. So quite different approaches. Yeah. Maybe the traffic control might be more on the BSD side of things, of stricter control.
I don't think that's necessarily a difference between like BSD as a license. It's just like this particular project versus the Linux kernel. But there are plenty of like GPL and like more Linux-oriented projects which are very strict as well. But I agree, there are simply different requirements, different cultures, and you just have to choose which one is more appropriate. Mm-hmm. And I agree that here, if you have a project which says the newest and the best stuff, but it crashes, that's probably not very appropriate in an airplane.
Well, if I want a fancy machine for computer games, I can go Linux. Perfect. Yeah. All the new hardware is supported, works, and if it crashes once in a month, it's okay. But if I want to run a stable server, which is mission critical, then I go BSD because, for example, I know BSD has an uptime of until 500 days, and then I have to unplug the system. So.
Hmm. I was going to say to Euro Control that the James Howison quadrant that you threw up, that's a very, very valuable planning tool because it actually points to something which I don't think I've heard anyone say today, which is that you can learn to walk before you run with this open source stuff. And if you think about the fourth quadrant, co-located non-volunteers, there's another word for that, which is employees. If you do nothing else in the next 12 months other than getting your co-located non-volunteers to share with each other, you don't have to worry about licensing, you don't have to worry about anything, just institutionalizing a process of sharing and learning. That's what's going to enable you to then go to the distributed non-volunteers, which is where you begin to partner with other organizations and firms. And from there, it strikes me, we're talking about motivation. If you actually had Eurocontrol and Eurocontrol's equivalents in other regions and the major manufacturers in on the game, you would have no trouble at all attracting the efforts of people who want to learn and want to contribute and want to be part of that, because suddenly you have this critical mass of community and industrial community, government community, and that in itself becomes an incentive if you're a young professional, an incentive to become involved. Yeah. But I think it actually all starts there in the CNV corner of use what you have.
Yeah, I think it's really all about creating a community and sharing, like pooling with other people, because if it was just about open source, the only thing you would really need to change, if since you buy software from companies, just put in a contract that it has to be open source. But that's not really what it's all about. You know, it's about more. It's creating that community, having people who look at the code and improve the quality.
There's a big difference between having the tools available to facilitate collaboration and meeting this like you said, giving them a reason to do it. Because I mean, if you think about bug reporting for Windows XP, is much more sophisticated than almost any other bug reporting tool I've found in the open source community in terms of the detailed dump of information and what Microsoft wants to send to itself. I've never hit send, right? Whereas I will actually take half an hour to write a bug report for an open source product. And the difference is not the tool, it's the motivation. What do you feel you're getting in return?
Okay, with these remarks, I would like to come to the last presentation of today. I think we have enough material, we have to reflect on it, on what would be the community, how to grow it, whether it would be realistic or not. But I think that material we have to absorb a bit and then come back to it. But there have been pointers to this in a number of presentations, so thank you for that.